Finance and Revenue Committee to order.
He needs to be way out here on the end.
Yeah. I'm happy.
Hello out there.
Really happy.
We're calling the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. I'm glad to see everybody's in such a good mood at 3:30 in the afternoon. I want to particularly thank all the members of the audience and my committee members for coming at this unscheduled time so that we can work on these two important bills. I'm going to start out by opening a public hearing on House Bill 3618 and ask Mazen to elucidate on that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3618 is the bill that you've talked about and discussed in the interim. This is the fixes that have been in the works for the estate tax issues. Remember, there was some issues that arose out of and the implementation of the rules that the Department of Revenue tried to put for House Bill 3201 from the 2007 session. This is Section 68 of the House Bill 3201. Now, this also was previously House Bill 3479 in the 07 session before it was folded into the big tax credit bill. And you've heard some of the discussions. The group from the State Bar and the CPAs came to one of your meetings in the interim, and they've discussed some of the issues that they've been looking at as practitioners and the difficulties that arose out of that implementation of the bill, as well as the Department of Revenue's issues. We've been looking at the bill for most of the interim in the session, and then when the special session or the supplemental session occurred, this bill comes to you from the House Revenue Committee. It has worked on this for most of the time since we started the this session, Madam Chair, and at the 3618-A or A, as it is now, comes to you from that route. And we will probably talk with a little more on the details and what we did in the House side in changing it and how it evolved with time from one permutation to the other until it reached this point. But I understand that you wanted the House Revenue Chair to...
That's correct. Representative Barnhart is here. But before we ask him up, my good colleague Senator Morse was asking whether a fishing operation that's part-time qualifies for this kind of treatment under the estate laws.
Madam Chair, under current law, as before we have this bill come into work, the current law is, to say the least, is not very clear of who exactly qualifies and under what conditions. This bill tries to put the different definitions. If you see the beginning of the first page of the bill is all primarily definitions of the commercial operations, commercial operation, commercial fishing operations. Was one of the issues that are not very clear in law. It is not one of the things also that is clear in federal law, so we've spent a lot of time codifying this these definitions into 3618. And the commercial fishing operations, if they comply basically or they have the same requirements that the bill has as a 50% of the commercial fishing property being 50% of the total estate, as well as the five out of the 8 year look back and forward, They would qualify under that definition.
Even if it was part-time? I mean, this really doesn't address part-time versus full-time operations.
Correct? No, Madam Chair, Senator Morris, it does not matter. As long as the amount of the property, the commercial fishing property, makes up 50% or more of the total estate, it doesn't matter whether the profession was, because it has a definition under which they are licensed through ORS definitions of licenses. So once those conditions are satisfied, the amount of hours they spend in the profession is probably not relevant.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing the question. I suspect that that when we call into question the criteria, if you wind up with someone that's fully employed in another business and has a commercial fishing license and represents 50% or greater of the estate, that then qualifies for the tax credit. I'm not sure that meets the intent of perpetuating a family business. So I just raised that issue. I'm not sure that it's something we need to tackle now, but in the future, it may be something that has consequences that are different than what we had intended in this bill.
Madam Chair, the one thing, and we will go more into details as you would look into the different conditions under which there is the material participation clause, also part of the thing. So the heirs who are taking over the business, they have to have a certain level of material participation. That material participation is defined in as we have it here and in federal law. It is probably not as strict as having number of hours, 40 hours or 50 hours, but the material participation issue is within that construct of how things are. So what would be led to the understanding that this profession is a family profession that will continue to be family profession because there is a material participation condition. There is 5 out of the 8 years forward and back to continue within the same type of business. And then there's the 50% of the amounts to be out of the total estate tax, total estate value. Putting all these conditions together would somehow put all these issues within from a family continuation of a business type of concept. At least that's a belief that we've done.
But my reading, Madam Chair, is that it would still open the opportunity for claiming the benefits in a part-time business. Something to maybe think about in the future.
I know. I just wish we had enough commercial fishing operations that it would be a big problem. But that's just me. Okay, I'm going to ask Representative Barnhart to come. I asked Representative Barnhart come today to tell us kind of the background of the bill and a little bit about his negotiations on the House side, and to publicly thank you, Representative Barnhart, for the incredible amount of work you did on this. This is a very complex area, and I really appreciate all the work you put in.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the Finance and Revenue Committee. I appreciate that comment, and I'm very glad to be here today. Let me just say...
You do have to identify yourself.
My name is... thank you. My name is Phil Barnhart. I'm the state representative from House District 11, which I like to call Central Lane and Linn Counties. That shows you that when I switch seats, I'm no different than any other witness. Let me say a couple of things by way of background that I think are important for the committee to know as you address the issues in this bill. The most important thing is that this bill does not come up in a vacuum. It comes up as a response to the law that we passed in the 07 regular session last year, and to concerns that were raised by the Department of Revenue and by a number of tax practitioners, those who practice in the area of estate planning primarily, who were concerned that the bill that we passed was essentially unmanageable for them. There were too many areas where they could not understand what the law was because we hadn't defined it clearly enough. And there were too many areas where, depending upon the choices that were made, your planning would be very, very different. The department, I think, originally thought that they could fill in these areas with regulations and ended up realizing that they really couldn't do that. Hence, the purpose of bringing this bill up during this special session rather than waiting until 09. You think about, so put yourself for just a moment in the position of the attorney or the accountant trying to advise an older client about setting up an estate plan, knowing that the answers you choose to give that client will not be litigated until after the client's death, and when it's too late to make any changes to the plan. So I fully understood why it was that the professionals came shaking their heads basically and asking for changes. We worked very closely with them to try to get with the result of this engrossed bill work with them on the technical issues. And they, of course, individually had personal positions on a number of the policy questions that we made, and some of them we agreed with them on and some of them we didn't. But we listened very, very carefully when they gave us professional technical advice on how to draft things. Now, and that's part of the reason why there's so many references to the Internal Revenue Code. They are used to working with the Internal Revenue Code, and it is the federal estate tax that tends to move estate plans because the tax rate is significantly higher than our tax rate. So when we used definitions found in the Internal Revenue Code, they're comfortable because they think they know what those definitions mean. I'm very pleased that they think they know what they mean, because then I don't have to. But I have read some of those materials, and I can tell you, if you're not an expert in that particular area of the law, you really are dependent upon the people who are in order to understand them. So if I may, let me just go through the issues we dealt with and what we chose to do about them. There are several kinds of issues. One of them is simply the not being able to understand what the law actually did. Was it an exemption in which the first $7.5 million of a natural resource property would be exempt from the tax unless the value of that asset was larger than $7.5 million, in which case there would be no tax savings at all? Was it an exclusion? And I may have these words backwards. Paul and Mazin will tell me if I've gotten them backwards. If it's an exclusion, then the first $7.5 million of every natural resource property would be excluded from the estate, and that would be true even if you were Les Schwab and you had a small farm on the side, and a multi-centimillionaire would still qualify under that definition. Or was it something else? Well, the bill was not clear about that, and the state tax people were very concerned. What we chose to do on that particular point was to get rid of both of those considerations and simply apply a credit, which you find on page 2 and 3 of the bill, on the estate tax, the purpose of which was to, or I should say there was one more issue, and that is this cliff issue. If your estate is worth less than $7.5 million, then you benefit from the laws that currently exist. If it's more than $7.5 million, you don't. So what if it's $7,501,000? All of a sudden, because you have that extra $1,000, you don't get any benefit. That's called the cliff. What we tried to do with that was to round that off so that estates worth, or natural resources properties worth more than $7.5 million, would still qualify for a partial reduction in taxes, and that's reflected starting on line 43 of page 2 and ending on line 6 of page 3, as you give them some relief from the tax. But going up through line 42 on page 2. The intention is essentially to not tax on natural resources properties worth $7.5 million or less for those estates that qualify. Now, there are several other issues that we had to deal with. One of them was that the definitions of what qualified as a natural resources property were not properly drawn. And the result was that it was the opinion of the department that trees on a tree lot were not covered. We had some testimony in our committee that that the land under the trees was only worth 15% of the total value of a tree lot in many instances. And if that's the case, then we missed the definition. So in fact, we had defined a tree lot in such a way that it was really not valuable for anybody because of the portion of it was did not include the trees, and of course that's part of what we were trying to include. Another piece of the definition that we missed was the rolling stock for farms. Farmers, of course, have combines and equipment for planting, tractors. They use large trucks for moving materials out to the fields and for bringing things back from the fields. And probably a variety of other things that I don't know anything about, but that are rolling stock that aren't real estate, and that were not included in a farming business. And also the definition of a fishing business was also very, very poorly defined. The result of that was that the value of the bill of the law that we currently have is relatively small for those businesses. What we were trying to accomplish in as I saw it last year, was allowing small natural resources businesses and properties that were family owned, that were illiquid, that did not have assets to pay these taxes, a break, so that they would not have to sell the business in order to pay the Oregon estate tax. That's what the purpose of the bill was. So, what changes did we make in order to accomplish that in this bill? And you've already talked about some of them. The first thing we did was we fixed the definition section so that it really does apply to trees, it does apply to rolling stock, and we have a real definition of a fishing business now, and that's mostly on page 2. We also wanted to limit it to a small and illiquid estates, and the way we got to that issue was to require that this property be at least 50% of the total adjusted gross estate. Now, as I learned from the lawyers, the adjusted gross estate is the estate, the value of all the assets in the estate minus what the estate owes. So you get to take the mortgages off before you get to the adjusted gross estate. And what's left is the adjusted gross estate. And if this property is worth half of the adjusted gross estate or more, then this law would apply. The point of that is it excludes the Les Schwabs of the world who may have a small farm. That might qualify under the $7.5 million rule, but certainly it would not apply to half of his estate, and therefore he would be excluded from it. And there's no reason why he should benefit from it because he has plenty of money, or his estate has plenty of money to pay the tax. And that was the theory of dealing with the illiquidity. Another point that we used in order to try to get to that issue was that if the total gross estate exceeds $15 million, there's no benefit. So in case we missed it somewhere else, there's no benefit. And we also applied this look backwards and look forward requirement that Manzin referred to. The point of that is there is no value to farmers if a small farm business becomes a tool for estate planning for those with large estates. It would end up resulting in an increase in value of those farming businesses artificially as part of an estate planning process in order to avoid taxes. So applying a look-backward rule in which you say that the decedent or some member of the family needs to have been involved in active management of the farm for 5 of the last 8 years, and they have to agree that they will continue in active management of the farm, some member of the family, for 5 of the next 8 years, then that takes care of that problem. All of a sudden, the value of the farm as a manipulation for large estates goes away. And I think, Madam Chair, I've hit the essence of the bill. What we did is we reduced we expanded the definition of what a natural resource property is by including trees, by including the rolling stock, and by writing a real definition for fishing businesses. And then we drew it in at the top by making sure that our original plan, which was to make certain that illiquid estates that would otherwise have to be sold, or businesses that would otherwise have to be sold in order to pay the estate taxes, could in fact remain in the family, because those estate taxes would be given a credit and would not have to be paid. That's the essence of the bill. There's a lot of details that go into this, and I commend the other witnesses to you for that, and I'll be certainly happy to answer any questions you have for me if I can.
And the purpose of all this is to keep agricultural land and forest land and nursery land in production rather than have it be liquidated.
And thank you. Yes, Madam Chair. And also vineyard land and other kinds of... I think that a wine business, a small winemaking business, could fall under this credit. And, in fact, the Oregon winemakers supported this bill in the House. I think it has a number of implications. Now, to get, if I could, just for a moment, to Senator Morris's bill, or a question earlier that he asked to Mazin, we were not focused on whether there was a full-time or a part-time or some other time participation in the business. What we were focused on that it was a family business, as I've defined it, that it was a large enough portion of the estate so that the estate could run into liquidity problems trying to pay the tax. Those were basically the issues. I think in the case of a fishing business, I don't think it's particularly uncommon for a fisherman to work part of the year out at sea fishing and another part of the year doing something else, because the fishing business works that way. Now, there are probably some fishermen back here who can give you a better statement about that. Similarly, for a tree lot, there are many times when active management of a tree lot may mean that you walk through the land a couple of times a year, and you listen to the scanner to make sure that you're not hearing fire calls in the neighborhood during the other parts of the year. When you've already made the decisions about what trees to plant and when to harvest and how much. So in that case, of course, you would assume that the tree lot owner has a job doing something else. And so applying a full-time, part-time rule to that kind of thing would not make any sense. But if the tree lot with the trees on it is more than half of the estate and it's worth less than $15 million and the total estate is worth less than $15 million, that tree lot ought to qualify in order to avoid having the family have to sell the tree lot in order to pay the taxes.
Thank you. Are there questions of Representative Barnett? Thank you, and thank you again for all your work, and we'll send you on your way.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate that very much.
Okay. We will start off with Sean Cleave, Barry Bushu, and Jeff Stone. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. We appreciate the opportunity to be here today. My name, for the record, is Barry Bushu. I'm currently serving as president of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation and farm somewhere between Gresham and Sandy in a little town called Boring. We welcome the opportunity to be here today. We'd like to thank both Chair Barnhart and yourself for taking an active interest in this responsible position that you have and looking at this very critical issue. One of the things that came out of the House committee in the hearing was a question as to whether or not this is an issue of an immediacy. And from our perspective, yes, it is. I mean, farmers are aging rapidly, and there are many of these situations, many of these farms right now that are faced with the position of trying to go through the heartache of having to destroy farms and sell them to meet the needs of tax breaks. My father died about a year and a half ago, and if it hadn't been for the planning that he and my mother had done, we'd be in a similar situation. And I often look back at him. He quit being a policeman and took up farming with his brother. farmed all day for his brother as an employee, and then him and my mother farmed at night on land they rented to try and establish themselves, and they did and did a very good job of it. And I sometimes am saddened to see that, frankly, without something like this, his only legacy could have been paying taxes an entire life, and the only benefit of dying was passing on that legacy to his children. I don't think that's something that this legislature or the public really wants. You may also hear a lot of discussion or some discussion today about the benefits that agriculture already gathers through various types of taxation programs and payments. I would like to just quickly address that. When you look at the National Farm Bill, which is the way in which Congress addresses the importance of agriculture to this nation, represents less than 1.75% of the entire nation's budget as an investment in agriculture. Part of that is conservation, part of that is energy, part of that is food stamps. The 66 2/3 of that is a direct payment for students' food stamps and nutrition programs. I don't think we have to apologize to anybody as an industry for the farm bill. We pay taxes on every payment we receive, if we receive any. Majority of those programs are designed to repay and, in fact, recognize the value that agriculture brings to society and the environment through conservation payments. If anything, I would be so bold as to say that a 1.5% investment in the greatest industry in the nation is really not very significant, and I'd ask you to just keep that in mind. This is one more hurdle that we can overcome to make sure that these family farms stay in the family and stay productive. And we're very thrilled with the work that's been done with the House. We would certainly ask you to support that version of the bill. That doesn't mean that it's a perfect bill. No bill that comes out of this legislative body can address everyone's needs, nor can it keep everyone happy. And I frankly don't envy the position you folks are in or trying to do that. But we welcome the opportunity to be part of that process in a collaborative manner. If you'll notice that there's a number of agricultural industry folks that have been working on this for months to try to bring forward a collaborative solution, which we believe addresses the vast majority of those issues. So with that, there's a lot of people here that want to testify today, and people with very personal stories as to how this impacts them. But frankly, Farm Bureau's position on this is that we want a bill. We certainly want it out of this session. Any irregularities in the bill that come up in the future, we'll have plenty of opportunity to look at, and we would certainly welcome the opportunity to look forward to bringing back the discussions about indexation and some of the other projects that we've got going. But once again, I want to thank you and the rest of the committee for their investment in this issue, and I'll hand it over to Sean Cleave.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mary. For the record, my name is Sean Cleave. I'm the Government Affairs Specialist for the Oregon Farm Bureau, and I'd like to thank you, Senator, for hearing this bill so quickly after receiving it. As Barry said, we did a lot of work in the House, and I'd like to publicly thank Representative Barnhart and other members of the House Revenue Committee for putting in a lot of extra late hours to work the issues out in this bill. As Barry said, not everything was resolved. There was a lot of discussion about two particular pieces that I'd like to just state for the record. Number one was the percentage test. That started out at 75%, meaning that you would have to have 75% of your total estate as a natural resource, as defined by this bill, in order to qualify. And we felt that that was a level, especially when talking to some of the Farm Bureau members, that would start to cause pause in whether they qualified or didn't qualify for the estate tax program that we were developing. It is now at 50%. That is probably a good level to start with. I think there's going to have to be a lot of evaluation as to who qualifies under this program moving forward and who doesn't, and whether or not that percentage is an appropriate level to create the outcome that we're looking for, which is to preserve small family farms that don't have any means to pay liquid tax penalties. The other piece that is a big difference from the legislation that passed in 07 was a removal of a indexing for inflation. So originally, the 07 legislation had an indexing factor at 7.5 million. That does not carry over into this bill. So over time, the program will have to be evaluated as that value shrinks because of inflation. I don't want to belabor the bill anymore because there are people here that want to talk, and I don't want to talk myself out of a yes vote from anybody on the committee. But I'm here to answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you. Go ahead, Jeff.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jeff Stone, Director of Government Relations for the Oregon Association of Nurseries. I will give you some prepared testimony, but suffice it to say that the bill passed last session and the bill before you today is not perfect. We've worked hard with the Oregon Farm Bureau, the Oregon Bar Association, the certified public accountants over the last 5 months to work out and hammer out a workable program. And I'm pleased to say that I believe that we have done so, and I'm proud of the many hours of dedication by legislators, by agriculture, and farm and fishery and forest interests and the state tax practitioners. We've come a long way to determine sensible definitions, provide assurance through the look back and look forward provisions, as Chair Barnhart mentioned already, and seek a compromise and fiscal responsibility during these tough budget times. We acknowledge that there are issues that remain unresolved and policies that would make it better for the long term. But we feel that this legislature must take seriously these policies, and you'll hear from the small woodlot owners, and take those very seriously and take into account that we must obtain real data about how this program was enacted and make sure that the tax policy is following the intent of the legislation passed last year. Once we received all this, I believe that the OAN and others will roll up their sleeves in 2009 and try to make it even better. Clearly, the interest of this bill is to make modifications in the definitions, and there was a lot of good faith built during the discussions last year and through the discussions this year. We feel, and that's why others that you'll get information from the Oregon Association of Nurseries, the Farm Bureau, Oregon Wine, the Oregon Cattlemen Association, and the Oregon Wheat Growers League support this bill fully, and we would appreciate your yes vote.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you. I'm going to take, Sean, why don't you stay up there, and I'm going to ask Mr. Chapin to come up and testify now. Welcome, Mr. Chapin.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jack Chapin, and I live out here at 411 Salmon Street North, which is just a hoop and a holler away, just 12 miles north of here, down along the Willamette River when the river's in its banks. And then the rest of the time I'm in the Willamette. But anyway, we have a beautiful farm there, and I've lived my life there. My father bought this farm in 1917. I was born in 21 and moved out the farm when I was a very small boy. I think I was less than 3 years old when I moved out. And I'd like to bring out this first point right here, that my father paid $100 an acre for that farm, $10,000 for a farm with, I think, there were a few cows that went with it. There was a house that was 25, 30 years old at that time, and it's still in use, and a barn, a big barn. And he only paid $100 an acre. I wish to bring this point out because I came from a meeting today. I chaired a meeting today. Oh, let's see, what do you call that? I'm a chairman of the Farm Tax Advisory Committee to the Marion County Assessor. Okay, and we got I got a fresh outlook on values. Last year, they talked of $7,000 an acre in my area in there, and under some conditions, maybe more. This year, they're talking more like $10,000 an acre. And my gosh, inflation's going on here so fast, we can't keep up. It'll eat us clean up. Now, to some people think, oh boy, you're worth so much more money now. But I can't take it with me. And I can't even leave it. So this is the problem. Now, I'd like to make a point or two here that kind of shows the sentiment that goes along with owning a farm. I grew up right on that farm, and strange boyhood, I slept in the barn from age 6 through age 18. So when people ask me, when I don't close the door, I say, were you raised in the barn? I said, well, yes, what's news? But I don't want you to feel sorry for that. I had a best boyhood in the world. Well, I had a gymnasium. I had a dog that slept with me, or beside me when the folks didn't know it. He slept with me part of the time. And people say, well, weren't you scared? No, I had a pitchfork right over here I could reach any time I needed it. Sat in the exact same spot. I had a hatchet right here and a club right there and a dog sleeping my feet. I slept good. And this is the way I grew up. I started work at a very young age, and we worked very hard, and we almost lost the farm. My father had to tell his young son one day that we were going to lose the farm and get kicked off. I don't know my age for sure. I'm going to guess it was 7, something like that. But he took me out and told me that we were going to lose the farm, that he could not raise the money. He just simply whipped and he couldn't do it. And it was very emotional. Well, we didn't lose the farm. And 20 years later, we paid for it. We went out that same door, and he stopped, and I was holding him because he's an old man then. I say 20 years, I believe it was a little over 20 years. Anyway, I was holding my father up just a little because he was beginning to show his age pretty heavy. And he stopped and gestured, and he held his hand out, and finally he spoke. He says, Jack, it's all ours. It's paid for. We went on a little ways further, and he said, I got that monkey off my back. It's ours. And it was such an event. Well, we went on, and I kept going. That we started with 100 acres, and I worked very hard. I worked like a galley slave all my life. I guess a workaholic or something or other, but I was born to be strong, and I put in the hours and got the jobs done. And I bought farms all around before I got done. The 100 acres is now a 500-acre block, and it's fully developed with orchards, filberts, and cherries, and I'm very, very proud of the farm. All of the low spots have been drained, and there's water for everything. I'm very proud of my farm. I've also bought other farms, and I have given in my lifetime. I've given 2 farms away that are each worth $1 million apiece, and I'm proud of that. I've helped sons buy farms. Now then, to give you an idea of what the value of this farm is to society, the first point I wanted to make was that I just added up my head, starting with my father's family. I was the 6th child. That farm did produce the major income to put 16 kids in college in my lifetime. There are hundreds of people who worked on that farm. There was one day that's kind of out of proportion, but we were picking evergreen blackberries on a 40-acre field, and we had 500 people working for us one day. My wife and I and our children, all working together, handled it. And we put off. We were making about $1,000 an hour net off of the berries leaving that farm that day. And it was a great thing. And that was the year I was able to help 2 children buy car. Not help them, I bought 2 cars, Corvairs, for 2 children that year, besides making big car farm payments. Anyway, the farm is a productive farm. And I have sons there farming. They're farmers. They're going strong. We want to keep on going from family to family. And I came up against a situation where maybe I've been a little bit lucky. I was fairly successful, I guess. And it's pretty hard to get it across. And I heard that this legislature, last session here, I got the news that had passed this bill raising the I don't use the words to use here, but the ante there to $7.5 million. And I thought, boy, that's good news, because certainly that would sure help me. And by the way, I've been working full time on this for about 14, 16 months, something like that, getting preparing to die. I want to go ahead and keep living a while yet, folks. I'm not quite there yet, but still at my age, 87 years of age, my wife is failing. It's time to think of death and get things across for the next generation. So I've been working steadily at that and spent the biggest share of the year doing that. And I thought this was great news. And then I heard, well, the LLCs are exempt. I don't get any benefit. Well, boy, that doesn't seem right. All I was doing was trying to make it all work to keep this family farm together. And so I hope, and I wanted to ask, may I ask, has that been taken care of?
Let me just address that question. That was one of the points that Representative Barnhart, I think, might have passed over, and that is that one of the changes we made in this bill from the bill we passed last year was we made it very clear that LLCs are covered.
Oh, well, thank
and,
you.
And so if the family farming operation, there are many legal entities that people use. And so we made sure that those are covered for the
intent of the bill. Very, very good. And I thank you for that. And I wanted to say, I had the bill read to me. You know, I'm blind. That's one of the things that I'm a little ashamed to come up here and speak, because I can't really see you folks. And it's it just happened in the last few years. I have macular degeneration. But I'm certainly happy for that, and I am pleased that the legislature's had the wisdom to do all this, because inflation, as I pointed out, is just hitting us hard and making millionaires out of a person that just barely can make a living. But anyway, it's not quite that bad. But anyway, I don't know. I'm running out of time here, and I haven't completed, but I've run out of time. Have I covered what you want? Here are the questions.
I think what I'm getting from your testimony, Mr. Chapin, is that this bill will help you in your planning for your estate. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, it will.
Okay. Well, thank you.
The plans are, and it's very confident, very clear that there's Chapins will go right down the line. I have two sons farming right tight there with me. And a grandson now that has stuck his neck out a mile and about to get married, I think. And there's a lot going. There's other grandchildren that want to go. It's a family farm that can go on if we can keep it going.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chapin. And I know personally when I voted for this bill, for the predecessor bill last session, and when I support this bill, it's farms like yours that I have clearly in mind, and I think others do as well. So thank you for coming. Well, are there questions from the committee? Thank you, Mr. Chapin.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Mike Goddard. I probably murdered your name. Goddard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good. Thank you.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike Goddard. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Small Woodlands Association and soon to be family forest landowner in Yamhill County. I'm glad to report to Representative Barnhart we have bought this land not for inheritance tax purposes. The Oregon Small Woodlands Association is a membership organization representing family forest lands. There are more than 40,000 family woodland owners in Oregon today. They mostly go unnoticed, although they produce about 16% of Oregon's wood products and maintain lands that are critical for a number of other services to the public, including drinking water, wildlife, and recreation. Combined, they own about 5 million acres of prime forest land, 40% of all privately owned timberland in Oregon, in parcels ranging from 2,000 to 5,000 acres. The long-term economic sustainability of family forests is a significant component in keeping forests in forest land. Since 1989, real prices received for timber products have declined, while the values of alternative uses have escalated, along with the cost of providing public benefits mandated through regulations, such as riparian setbacks and enhanced wildlife habitat, many of which family woodland owners see as important personal and public values. Other costs like fire protection have skyrocketed, and so that in eastern Oregon today, The annual cost of carrying out fire protection assessments is greater than any property tax in many counties. In spite of our state land use system, Oregon experiences an average loss of 25,000 acres of forest, family forest land to other uses each year. While families do not want to see their forest lands converted, there is a tremendous economic pressure to do so. One of these pressures is paying the inheritance tax. As you know, the Oregon legislator wrestled with this question just 8 months ago, and we thank you for the efforts, and answered with a policy choice designed to provide a pathway for families to pass resource lands onto future generations. The tax and planning community and the Department of Revenue brought forward implementations, questions highlighting an unlimited revenue impact to Oregon. While House Bill 3618A addresses many implementation issues for attorneys and accountants, it does depart, we believe, from the provisions of the existing law in three significant ways. The newly crafted tax credit is biased against smaller estates by only providing a dollar-for-dollar credit when an estate gets to $7.5 million in natural resource value. The bill repeals indexing provisions, as has been stated already, protecting the value of the resource land against inflationary pressures. And the bill requires a new threshold to qualify. 50% of the adjusted gross value of the estate must be comprised of natural resource property. That 50% qualification threshold will set the bar impossibly high for many small parcels of forest land. This threshold presumes that family woodland owners live on their land and would have a forest dwelling to count towards that 50% criteria. Oregon Small Woodlands Association would suggest that this is not the case. The Department of Forestry estimates that 1 million acres of Oregon forests lie within urban growth boundaries or on other development zones which are like the wild urban interface. These lands are small forest parcels that would never qualify under the 50% threshold, yet are the very same lands at risk to development. The Oregon Small Woodlands Association remains concerned that the numbers of small timber parcels that were excluded from any estate tax provision under House Bill 3618. Several House Democrats have shared this concern, and we have attached a memo to our testimony, and join us in encouraging the committee to consider amendments to lower the threshold participation from 50% of the adjusted gross value of an estate to 25% for family forest woodland owners only. We thank you for your consideration in this matter.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, I'd like Fred Van Etta and Gary Johnson.
Go ahead.
Welcome.
I am Fred Van Etta, appearing before you as a member of the Oregon Small Woodlots Association and the manager of an LLC that has eight family members in it that owns timberland that in the last 7 years went through the old inheritance tax process. And I will stay with that maybe for just one additional couple of sentences. The effect on our family operation was that we clear cut a third of our property, something we would never have done if it hadn't been for the inheritance tax that we had to pay. So you're on the right track. I believe that you should reduce the 50% to adopt the amendment that I haven't seen the language of, but that we had talked about, that you should establish the 25% factor for forest ownerships only, because the effect of what you're doing is cutting out many smaller timber holdings from the effect of this measure, and what you're trying to do is make it possible for the ownership of the land to go from one generation to the other and still manage it under the plan that had been established for it. I know in my case, whether you do the 25% or the 50% has no effect on me, and I It's a little hard to tell, but I don't think it would have any effect on any of the other seven members of the family LLC that I manage. So I'm not here trying to feather my own nest. It is a matter of the effect on the kinds of properties that you affect. Now, part of the testimony we heard that if your Les Schwab's estate, it doesn't matter. You can pay the taxes. Certainly true in his case, but as you move down to the average family that where they have a house and a job, and they have accumulated some timberland either through inheritance or through the purchase of it, there's not a lot of cash there to pay the taxes, and anything and their only solution is under the easiest thing to do is to go cut the trees down. That's the easiest, quickest way to get cash. And if you deal with the inheritance taxes, they don't wait. They are not the State Department of Revenue and the IRS are not patient at all. They want their money almost immediately, and you've got to convert whatever you can to cash to get it. So the thrust of my testimony is look seriously at the 25% factor for forest products, because you will maintain more of the timberland in production rather than people having to go cut it prematurely. I'm not philosophically against clear cutting, but in the Coast Range, you don't clear cut a 70-year-old tree if you're using wise management. When it's 150 years old, maybe you'll clear cut it if you haven't selectively harvested it before then. But if you've got to have cash, you have no other choices but to cut the timber prematurely. And to the extent that this helps that, I think you should include as many small timber owners as possible, because it'll keep it in the family ownership and keep trees growing on it.
I've actually been on your tree farm. I think you remember many years ago. It's a very impressive operation. But what I hear you saying is that if this had been in effect when the last transition happened, you wouldn't have had to clear cut those trees.
Because of the effect of the federal law, we would still have had to do some clear cutting. Mm-hmm. But the less you can do, the better off you are. And we don't here have our lever over the federal law, although as my father had the grace to live till 2010, at which time he'd have been 103 years old, we wouldn't have had to clear cut anything. Because of the federal law.
But this definitely would have helped you. You would have been covered under this, is what I'm talking
under
about.
In 2001, when we dealt with his problem, right, it would have been covered and it would have helped us. And in the future, there are a lot of timberland holders that are. We had 1,500 acres in our estate. But many of the people that would be affected by this have much smaller portion. The land is in much smaller parcels than that, and that you're valuing the land against their home, and saying if the land is more than 50%. They're not eligible, and I think that
they are eligible.
Are
it's
they,
more than
if the land,
if it's under 50%.
Yeah,
the land and the trees.
Yeah, the land and trees, and I think you should reduce it to 25%, so you make more people eligible.
Okay. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Chair, I have a question.
Senator Starr.
And I should ask the other,
the guy from the Small Woodlands Association. But were these issues raised in the House, and were there amendments that were drafted to accomplish this? Was this just brought to everybody's attention after the bill was on its way out of the committee on the way to the House? Because I haven't had anybody from the Small Woodlands Association come and talk to me. I heard it through other members that the Small Woodlands had a problem, but nobody's came and talked to me about it. Do we have an amendment to accomplish the issues that the Small Woodlands are wanting to try to accomplish to change this bill, to amend this bill?
Actually, I can answer that. There was a push in the House to try to get down to the 25% for this purpose, and there was a great discussion on the House floor. The problem is when you go down to 25%, the revenue impact skyrockets because you're wrapping in so many more different things. And one of the goals in fixing this bill was to, because of our budget situation, was to stay within the parameters of the revenue impact that we had from last year's bill. And so that was a constant tension. It's expensive to do that.
So, Madam Chair, nobody has had an amendment drafted that you're aware of?
Well, I think there are amendments floating around out there.
It was my understanding there were amendments for the committee's consideration.
Not in my packet. I haven't seen them.
Other questions? Thank you. Okay. Yes.
Excuse me. Do we have, I understand if we expand the amount to be allowed, but as it relates specifically to the small woodlot owners, do we have a figure?
We do. Mazin has kind of computed what the revenue impact would be.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Westland, there's two issues that come into play in this particular issue that we have here in front of us. When we first started this effort, we looked at the data is not necessarily the most impressive that there is, but we had to start with putting a very important ceiling on the top. And the ceiling for whole properties that are classified as natural resource properties. We went to the statistics of income and found out what kind of assets out of the total assets does that make. We found that these assets make about 5% of what totally is there. Now, we also went for some IRS studies, and we found about the occupations by which you have fishing, forestry, and farms make out of the filing of these. It's about 6% of those occupation is within the people who file for the state tax.
I think the question, Mazin, is we're trying to get a bottom line on what the revenue impact would be if we had a 25% threshold for woodlands.
And Madam Chair, I'm trying to give you a number and then give you the caveat. We're starting the caveats here.
All right.
I want to be a good economist if I haven't done that.
Okay,
yet,
so. Let's move it along.
Now, the ceiling that we put, Madam Chair, at the time of the forecast, we were looking about, at that time, we were looking at about $3.75 million a year. Now, that was based on the previous forecast. With the new forecast, you're talking about $4 million a year. Now, with the 25%, we were looking at about $2.8 million. However, that $2.8 million assumes that we have all the other variables staying fixed. Now, the issue with the 25%, as all the studies have shown, is once you start going in that direction, you are looking at a whole different policy. The policy becomes that you want to, the intent to preserve land in that category rather than land owned by families
as the intent of the original bill is. And what happens here is that there starts occurring a market distortion of some sort. And the market distortion says that this land becomes desirable in estate planning purposes. And once that starts occurring, the land that you're trying to preserve becomes actually higher in price, which starts escalating in the price effects of that land and starts pushing it to the point where it is not feasible to keep that land in that price anyhow, which becomes a counter policy intent than when you started with. That's one of the issues that the other thing that it might be a lot more people buying for these issues, but they're not buying it to as the family type of establishment that there is. So you start with about the 2.8 million, and then you add all the other.
And the revenue impact for the 50% is about a million, right?
Right, about 1.2, right.
So it doubles, basically, the revenue impact. Thank you,
Madam Chair. But, Madam Chair, isn't the purpose of the legislation to clarify the intent of what we did last year? And wasn't the small woodlands as part of the bill from last year? I mean, wasn't that the intent of the bill last year, is to accomplish what Mr. Venata's family had to kind of go through and other...
That's correct, and the bill as it is would benefit Mr. Van Atta's family and other timber operations where they comprise 50% or more of the estate.
But you cut out a vast majority of woodland owners by adding that 50%.
Yeah, and that is
counter to the intent of the bill we passed last year.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, we're trying to keep land in production, but as Mazin said, if it becomes an estate planning tool, then the pressure... actually goes in the other direction, where large estates might try to acquire some of these small woodlands as an estate planning tool because of the exemption, and which would escalate the price. So,
Madam Chair, this is the same way was discussed also in the House. This is the same way you would look in what's so-called hobby farms. And if the intent was to preserve farms, period, hobby farms would be included. If the idea is to preserve farmland in a family business to maintain being productive in the same way, then that has just changed.
Right.
And the hobby farm is not included in that definition. So there's that fine line with the...
So there's a policy issue and there's a practicality issue of where would we get the money for moving down to a lower level, given the forecast.
The other question is, why was the escalation taken out of the bill? I mean, we had it in the basically cost of living increase in the exemption every year. Why was that taken out of this bill when it was in the legislation we passed?
The indexing.
Year? Yeah, the indexing.
And a lot of things have changed with the bill. Of course, the main... the bill at the time when it was done in 2007, House Bill 3201, which, as I said, before that it was House Bill 3479, the discussion of it at one time was that it is to be used in the same way as the federal law is used, or the federal code is used. Now, the language came out at the end saying, no, you may not include... which didn't say either include or say exempt. So it was somewhere the language not clear exactly where you go with it. So a lot of the issues of the bill was to clean it up and in the same time find a way and be able to track what happens. I think the intent was to track what happens from this point, so we're able to build conclusions with what we learn as the time comes. Once we learn these definitions, I think I've heard a lot of discussion that the idea of the indexing might be looked at as realistically that we have looked at the numbers without necessarily being lost with all these issues.
I think we'll continue this type of discussion after we hear some of our witnesses. I'm sure you're fascinated by this.
If I may, Madam Chair, Fred Venata again, just one comment about the issue raised about wealthy estates buying timberland to benefit from the taxes. If we have the 50% rule as opposed to the 25% rule, you'd have to buy twice as much of the timberland. And if your concern is there's a danger that people will be buying the land, they have to buy twice as much of it to meet the 50% rule as they do the 25% rule. And if it's a bad thing, then you're better off to have the 25% rule than the 50% rule.
Well, that's one way of looking at it. Okay, I'm going to let the very patient Mr. Freeburn.
I'm Gary Johnson.
Oh, you're Gary Johnson. Sorry about that. Mr. Freeburn is next. Go ahead.
Okay. Madam Chair and Committee, I'm Gary Johnson, and I happen to be the second Vice President of Oregon Farm Bureau. And this issue's really struck home to me because on Christmas Eve, my father passed away at 87, which was my father, my partner, and my best friend. I'm a fourth-generation farmer in Carleton. And probably the only reason that I'm the fourth generation is when the family members passed away in the past, the value of our land was a lot lower, and we didn't have the astronomical amounts of money that we would have to put out to pay the estate tax. We've done all the, estate planning. My folks had set up a living trust. So now I'm dealing with the living trust and going through the process and working on it. And we've spent a lot of money in the past with lawyers to get that set up, and we're continually now spending more money to get this next step taken care of.
Mr. Johnson, could you really just get to the point on the bill, because we're kind of running out of time here. I appreciate it.
The biggest thing is we've always done risk management in farms to be able to survive. And with the change of what came out of the House committee fits agriculture a lot better, maybe there needs to be more changes on it, but what we have at the present time, it will make our operation continue. And that's the main thing. We need to keep continuing our farming operations. And I spent almost 40 years farming. I started when I was in junior high and farmed through high school, and then started a partnership with my father. And I want to be able, I want to be able to go to my grave knowing I still kept the farm going, not losing it and having to sell. So that's the key point.
Well, and thank you for doing what you do as an eater.
And the last comment I guess I can say is, with long discussions I've had with Senator Wyden, his comment is, for agriculture, the tax man should not cometh. So.
Very well said. Thank you. Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you. Okay, Dean Freeburn.
Madam Chair, my name is Dean Freeborn. I and the rest of the committee, I farm west of Salem here, about 7 miles with my daughter. We're both full-time farmers, and the main reason I'm concerned about this is I went through it once, my brother and I, when my father passed away at age 57. As one of the representatives said on the other side, something about, well, is it a real emergency? Well, if it only becomes an emergency when somebody dies, and especially when it's unexpectedly. And so I'm approaching that age now, and my daughter's farming full-time with me. I'm hoping that without having to, as your previous witness said, spend a bunch of money making, and I don't want to offend anybody, but a bunch of lawyers rich and whatever to try to save the thing. It would be nice to be able to move it to the next generation instead of having to go through exactly what we did if something would happen to me unexpectedly. And so there is some improvements that could be done to the bill, obviously, but it's a lot better than what came out last time. I mean, I thought we were there last time, but obviously there was some things needed to be corrected. I think, by and large, a lot of them have been done. And if you really want to keep family farms in existence in the coming years, why, you're going to have to do something like this, because whether it would be such as the one that was passed last time, and I said this in the House side, if machinery wasn't included, how good would it be for her to keep the farm if she didn't have the machinery? And it's getting ridiculous, to say the least, the dollars that my father would have a fit if he even come close to knowing what I paid for the last combine, or paying for the last combine that we bought. So by the time you add all that up, why, we've got more machinery than his whole land holdings were at the time he passed away. And so anyway, this is a good step forward, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here and speak to you, and thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Thank you for coming. Okay, Jody Weiser and Amy Reen. Jody, I'd like to ask you guys to be really quick. We've got another.
I'm going to leave out my farm story.
You what?
I'll leave out my farm story. you know, I first started coming down to
Salem. Okay, introduce yourself.
I'm sorry, Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon, and this is Amy Green, who's interning with us. I first started coming down to Salem in 2003, and for that whole session, the estate tax was the only issue that we talked about. And so a number of you have already heard the story of my farm, and but I will briefly say that in the last decade, we've had two deaths. We had actually three deaths, but both two generations, my generation and my parents' generation, both died. We paid the estate tax twice, and we're not adverse to paying the estate tax. And part of the reason we're not adverse to paying the estate tax is because we did tax planning. So since my brothers were in the operation, much of the farm was in their name by the time my parents died. And we had insurance against emergencies. And when my brother died, we had key man insurance to take care of the issues that created. And that's the kind of planning that farmers generally do. I mean, you have to plan your crops. Probably executives at big corporations have to do the same level of planning that farmers have to do in order to be successful. So I don't. It's not really an unfair burden. It's just a burden of life for farmers to do estate tax planning just as they do other kinds of planning. But also, we really hadn't paid very many taxes at all. Oh, I forgot to pick these up. Take them over to her. Farmers generally really don't pay very much in taxes. The document that Amy is bringing over shows payments by farms in the state of Oregon for income earned, and that shows two different years, and it shows that in every category of size, as a group, the farmers lost money. And that's the way it is. Every year at Christmas time, when we wanted to go on vacation, my dad would say, sorry, but this is when we farm taxes. And we used that period of time to figure out how much revenue there was that was going to be taxed if we didn't spend it. And that's when land was bought, machinery was bought, seed for the next year was bought, etc., until pretty soon there was actually no profit showing for that year. And so, in fact, most farmers, unless they have a really good year, haven't paid income taxes. The property taxes have been reduced from what they used to be. Farmers used to pay at full value, and they now pay at reduced value. And so, really, the estate tax is the only tax some farmers ever pay. The difference between some farmers and us is that we acknowledge that we didn't do it ourselves. Without the government, where we farmed would have been a desert. The state provided roads, courthouses, workforce development, research, unemployment insurance, water, a monetary system we could plan on, disaster relief money, crop subsidies, futures markets for our crops, electricity for our homes, etc. We were blessed that we started with land that was bought for $100 an acre and was worth $3,200 an acre when my father died, and about the same value when my brother died 2 years later. Without the government, we would have still be using pesticides with severe consequences to the environment, our workers, and ourselves. We used to spray DDT on our house. Without the government, we would have been at the mercy of sellers and buyers without the protection of the courts and banking regulations. Without the government, we wouldn't have had roads or trains to get our products to market. And without the government, there would have been no regulated market in which to sell our products. Literally, our farm would have remained a desert. So I'm glad you're seeing this bill. I'm glad that it's been worked this session. I think there are a couple of problems with it that really still need to be addressed now, because if we don't address them, they become a three-fifths rule later on. It's unclear in several places in the bill whether material participation is required or not. It's unclear in the go-back period. It's unclear for farms that are not held in entities, and it's unclear in the follow-up period whether material participation is required or not. So you're really saying, do you want landowners or do you want farmers? What was the goal here? One of the problems is this is a tax credit bill, but nobody has ever really decided clearly what our goals are. So it's a moving target. One day it's farmers, preservation of the family. The other day it's preservation of the land in current use. But we're really only requiring this land to be in current use for another 5 years. And the way the law is currently written, if you sell it after 3, you still get a tax credit of about $140,000 a year for each year you didn't sell it, if you had happened to use the full exact amount available. I have a list of proposed changes in the line numbers. I don't know if you really want to go through them, but they're basically to get material participation clearly put in the bill at all 3 places. I think that you should disallow discounts on assets that are held in entities, and Amy will go into that. And there really should be no benefit if you don't hold the property in use for at least 5 years. There's no reason to give a benefit if somebody holds it for 2 years and sells. That's what we did with my brother. It took that long to make a decision and sell. But we were just farming the land and making money. We weren't doing anything special for society while we were doing that. Amy, you want to go through that second sheet?
So thank you, and I would ask you again to be as brief as possible.
Madam Chairman and committee members, thank you for listening. My name is Amy Ween, and I'm an intern with Tax Fairness Oregon. I'm going to briefly take you through a scenario of possible unintended consequences of this bill. I'm going to illustrate a hypothetical farm that's worth $57 million, which doesn't sound like a small family farm that we are trying to preserve. Of this farm, let's say that there are multiple owners. The farm has deeded to children and grandchildren and other relatives, partial interest in the farm, so there are multiple owners. And let's say dad's portion of the farm is $20 million, mom's is $20 million, and there is $15 million in cash and assets, liquid assets, of which each parent has half. Now, when dad dies, because the appraiser comes and his $20 million farm might be appraised at 15, which is commonly done, because there are multiple owners and that has established that reduces marketability, then he might get a discount of 50%, and there is data that shows that the average reduction by discount is 51% for farms. So that reduces his value of his estate to $7.5 million. Now, if he has $7.5 million in cash, he just barely makes the 50% rule. So let's say that he does the 50% rule, and he will, by the calculations in the bill, the family will owe approximately $1.8 million in taxes, and they will get a tax credit of $705,000 approximately for each of the estates of mom and dad. So you have here a farm that is not a small family farm. Seems to be a large farm with significant cash assets. It still qualifies for the benefit in this bill. And that will cost, so the fiscal impact for the state of Oregon will be considerable. And there are a lot of different ways. There's a list at the bottom that shows a lot of different ways that the tax can be paid, including, in particular, a provision that if a family is unable to pay the tax immediately, they can pay over 14 years. So they might not have to liquidate a significant portion of the farm or the forest in order to pay immediately. And I think that's all I have to say. Thank you. Do you have any questions? We're both here.
Yeah, I wanted Mazin to just respond to that a little bit on the multiple ownership issue and how it would be affected by this bill.
Madam Chair, the hypothetical example could probably work. It's a hypothetical example in the sense. However, the amounts that we the bill looks at. This is the bill was trying to make certain things apply to a very small number of people. I mean, remember the universe that we're looking at is not that many. I mean, we're looking about 6-7 people a year within that problem. To have this issue, that kind of example happen in this way might not be a common occurrence, or it might be a lot more rare than it is. However, if all the parameters impact and affect this work would be some amounts of loss. I mean, that's possible, but.
All right. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Okay, that ends our witness list. And I think Senator Monroe wanted to vote on this. Do we have Senator Westland's here? I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3618. And given the timing of this session, I think it's very clear from some of the testimony that this is going to be an ongoing discussion, probably in the 2009 session and possibly after. But it would be my intention to move this bill back as we received it, given all the work that was done on the House side. And so with that, I will open a work session on House Bill 3618. And ask Senator Morse for a motion.
Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 3618 be adopted and passed to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Morse has moved House Bill 3618 to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Okay, I think I will go ahead and just gavel this in and then offer Senator Monroe, when he gets back, a chance to be recorded if he wishes. So adopted. I will carry it. We have another bill on our agenda here that has fewer witnesses signed up, but some. We will open a hearing on House Bill 3619. And change council, change advisors, change economists. Thank you, Margaret. We have the sign up real good. Okay. Mr. Alanak, what do you have to tell us about House Bill 3619?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3619 largely deals with a portion of the Betsy credits, and it also expands the affordable housing lender credit.
Could you hold off on there? I'm going to recess the public hearing on House Bill 3619 and reopen the work session on House Bill 3618 and ask for a suspension of the rules to allow Senator Monroe to vote on House Bill 3618. Without objection. Senator Monroe will be recorded as an aye vote on 3618. Thank you, Senator Monroe. With that, I will reopen the public hearing on close of work session on House Bill 3618, reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3619, and you can continue.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it makes a few changes to the Betsy credit. And in Section 1 of the bill, it adds a number of criteria that the Department of Energy can establish by rule in terms of determining eligibility for the renewable energy resource equipment manufacturing facility. And those criteria include standards pertaining to what constitutes a single renewable energy resource equipment manufacturing facility and what property is included in that definition or not. There would standards relating to the level of increased employment related to these facilities, standards relating to the financial viability of the applicant under the preliminary certification, and then standards relating to the likelihood of long-term success of the project. So the rules are established there, and then in Section 2, it changes the maximum cost for the facilities with respect to the credit from $20 million to $40 million, and this is actually consistent with what Energy has adopted via the rules process. In current law and under the rules, facilities are allowed two $20 million certificates, so this change to $40 million eliminates the need for the multiple certifications, so there's really no change in the maximum dollar amount that's eligible for the credit. It's just a change in the way that's done. Rather than multiple certifications, it just streamlines that process. The bill also allows the department to certify a lesser amount of total cost for the credit depending on certain criteria, and those are also outlined in Section 2, and those pertain to there are a couple of forecast pieces in there. And the first one is if the revenue available for the general fund in the next biennium is less than 3% of the appropriations in the current biennium. That's one of the objective criteria. Another one is whether or not the current biennium will be at least 2% below the forecast on which the legislature adopted the budget. And there are three other criteria. The first of those three is whether or not the proposed facility has a likelihood of success, whether or not it's likely to increase the employment, and whether or not the applicant maintains a minimum level of financial viability. These are all kind of sideboards to the bill to make sure that the project is a legitimate project and is expected to move forward so that there will be some return to the state for the credits that are issued. Section 3 of the bill, it just adds that the preliminary certification that is obtained is valid for 5 years, and this will enable some large projects to get pre-certification all at once, and they will unroll multiple facilities over the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years rather than having to go back to the pre-certification process for each subsequent facility. They can do it all at once. And as long as they unroll those projects within 5 years, they're good to go with the pre-certs. Section 4 is just a language clarification pertaining to when the director of the Department of Energy has to consult the Public Utility Commission. And Section 5 pertains to the clawbacks, if you will. It makes it clear that under current law, when a credit is sold under 469206 to a third party who has nothing to do with the project, that if the certificate is revoked, the person or companies that have purchased those credits are held harmless. And the bill allows the Department of Revenue to recoup the loss of taxes paid upon revocation. But the pass-through partners are held harmless in that process. Section 6 is the affordable housing lenders credit piece, and the only change there is on page 7, line 25, where under current law, the cap to that credit is at $13 million per fiscal year, and that cap is increased to $17 million per fiscal year, and this allows the housing department to leverage these credits to maintain some federal subsidies. Do you want me to talk about the amendments, or you want to hold off on those?
We'll hold off on the amendments until we take the testimony. So basically, we have two kinds of tax credits in this bill, the Betsy, the Business Energy Tax Credit, and the Housing Tax Credit. So we'll start off with the Betsy credit with Mike Greaney from the Department of Energy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Mike Greaney, Director of the Department of Energy. We support House Bill 3619 and appreciate very much your considering this and working with us on this bill. Chris really summarized it well, and I won't repeat that. I mean, just mention that what we found as we were trying to implement the legislation that you passed last year that allowed renewable energy manufacturing facilities to qualify for the tax credit, that they really are different than either energy efficiency projects that you put into buildings like efficient lighting or windmills and other renewable energy that generate electricity, that these present different issues, and we needed both some clarification as to criteria and expectations for approving such facilities, and that such facilities are larger and potentially could be divided into more than one project, but we needed guidance on that as well. And the legislation you have before you provides that, and we think will be very helpful in dealing with these large manufacturing facilities that are now very interested in Oregon because of the increased tax credit that you provided last session. So that increase, it's accomplishing what we wanted, but we needed some tools to be able to respond to those inquiries.
Now, we gave you some discretion in this bill with the Department of Energy to really make some judgments about who these tax credits go to. Do you feel that this bill will enable you to really kind of winnow out the fly-by-night operations or the operations that really would not get us that much for our tax credit investment?
Yes, Madam Chair, because this allows us forces us to make some determinations, and then in turn we can condition the tax credit on accomplishing some of these expectations, for example, jobs or period of operation. And I think that is important because unlike energy efficiency that's built into a building that's always going to be there, or wind turbines that are operating regardless of who owns them that are going to generate electricity, you could have a situation where a company receives a large tax credit to invest in solar manufacturing, builds the facility, but then shuts down after, let's say, 1 year, and the state is left with just a large warehouse or whoever the next buyer is. And the jobs, the economic benefits, the clustering of renewable manufacturing facilities that the state was expecting are not there. So that's part of what's different about that type of facility and why we need this legislation.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hess.
Are you talking about the section, the standards?
Primarily, Madam Chair, Senator Hess, that's correct. Although both the standards and then the ability to reclaim the tax credit in the event the standards aren't met are all part of the same package, really.
Forgive me for not being here in 07. I feel like I came into a movie halfway through. But I was surprised to read some of this, you know, that you had discretion to, you know, look at financial viability or the likelihood of long-term success.
Madam Chair, Senator Hess, we do not have that ability currently, and we do not review projects for energy efficiency or renewable energy for that.
Yes, this would give you that.
But only for these manufacturing facilities. That's correct. And only for those with the criteria that are laid out in the bill that we would have to define further by rule. And again, it would not apply to most of the businesses that do lighting, heating efficiency, or develop renewable energy projects that generate electricity or generate heat. Those would continue to be, from our perspective, if they qualify technically and meet the payback criteria, they get the tax credit. There's no discretion there. It's only for these large manufacturing facilities.
So there's a rulemaking process on things like likelihood of long-term success?
Madam Chair, Senator Hess, we would do that in our rules, yes.
Where did this language come from?
Madam Chair, Senator Hess, this was something that we discussed both with the Governor's Office and Department of Economic Development, as well as the chairs of the two revenue committees, as ways to further define this tax credit.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question focuses along a similar line with respect to the standards as they apply to increasing employment, and the language is exceedingly vague. And maybe you could clarify what has been established by rule under ORS 469.197. When I looked at that statute, it does not occur to me that that statute applies to manufacturing. It applies to installations and residences and things like that.
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, we have not imposed such standards previously. This is new language. So this would and this would apply just to manufacturing facilities. Projects that save energy just have to meet an efficiency standard and a cost-effective payback requirement, and renewable energy that generates electricity or heat simply has to qualify technically as a renewable energy source, and we base the credit based on the actual cost of the facility. So these parameters would only apply to manufacturing facilities.
Can you give us a little bit better example of what you would anticipate that minimum threshold level of employment would be?
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, I can't give you a specific one. We would work closely with Department of Economic Development on a recommended standard for adoption in our rules. But we have not, you know, come up with a specific number or ratio or anything in advance.
Would a follow-up, Madam Chair?
Please.
Would a wind farm that has virtually no employment qualify?
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, a wind farm would not be subject to these findings because it generates electricity from renewable energy. So there you have a situation where we simply determine that it's renewable because it's wind, and what's the eligible cost, and that's based on certified by a CPA on the actual cost of construction, and that's what the tax credit is based on. So these economic criteria would only apply to manufacturing facilities such as solar, wind components, potentially fuel cell components, that type of thing.
But we're still very vague in terms of what employment levels would be required to receive this.
Well, isn't it true that that part of the reason for this is if you have multiple requests, that would play a role in prioritizing some of them over others?
Madam Chair, that's correct, and that could help determine how much we would allocate of this tax credit to competing firms, for example. And this is viewed by the Economic Development Department and by the Governor's Office as an economic development tool, and with the criteria and the potential for recapture, it's almost like a grant or a loan rather than a traditional tax credit.
Any other questions? While you're there, while we're talking about the criteria, there is in committee, you have it in your packet, a -A13 amendment, which I'm sure you've seen, which would add to your discretion when you're evaluating these things, the fact that you can consider whether the firm would be likely to come without a tax credit. In other words, that you could... You could say it's likely that they would come anyway, so why waste a tax credit?
Yes, Madam Chair, and that's a criteria that I think would be helpful combined with the others. And maybe I should mention that when a company applies for tax credits, we issue, before they actually spend any money, what's called a preliminary certification, and that determines the amount that we approve that if the company goes ahead and builds the facility as described in its preliminary certification, then it would receive a final certification that's used as a tax credit, and that determines the amount of the tax credit. But so the company would know in advance, if it goes ahead, what the tax credit would be that it would receive. And that applies to all projects, so that the company has certainty in proceeding. But at the same time, there's no tax benefit until the project is completed and we require verification that the project has been completed as described.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Greeny? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brian Doherty is signed up to talk on this part of the bill.
All right. Okay.
Welcome.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Brian Doherty for the Miller & Ash Law Firm, testifying on behalf of Obsidian Finance Group, which is a bunch of former lawyers that are of my law firm that went out and had some sense to get into the real business world. We are here testifying today in support of this bill and in support of the amendment. I'd like to offer some things that we've been working on. I first of all want to thank...
Oh, wait. Before you go on, you're talking about the Dash A-17.
Excuse me, the Dash A-17s and the bill itself. And to offer some things, I first want to thank Senator Burdick, Representative Barnhart, Chris Allen, and Paul Warner, and Legislative Counsel Kate Toswell, who have been working day and night, and I've been pestering them a bit, and we've been having quite a few attorneys and revenue folks working on this to try and get this transfer portion of this clear. And I'm referring primarily to Section 5 of the bill and the Dash A-17 amendments. And this workup here is much better. One of the problems we have is that we're referring to a certificate for this facility. And a certificate could be the certificate of operation, but it's also the tax credit certificate that gets transferred to a transferee. We have all agreed that we want to hold the transferee harmless, and that's important in any of these transfers. In the transferability of the certificate, that you do hold them harmless. The language here in the Dash A-17 makes that much more clear under subsection 6. There is a few, I think, unintended consequences that have occurred that I'd like to bring up that I hope we could correct if we do buy an amendment before you vote this bill out. If you're voting it out tomorrow, if you're voting out tonight, it may be a problem. But what it is, there are two areas where we have wording in here that has been changed. If you look at page 5 of the bill, line 27, we have removed the phrase pursuant to subsection 1A of this section. And I believe, from talking to Mr. Graney, that the intent was to allow you to revoke the certificate and obtain the taxes back from a manufacturing facility that does not fulfill its promises, such as creating more jobs, to do other things while it's operating. What you've actually done is created a revocation of the entire tax credit for someone that under sub 1A commits fraud, which is appropriate, but under 1B, it was one where they might no longer operate. And what happens is that suppose you have someone that operates a wind farm, and after 4 or 5 years, they decide these windmills aren't working. There was no condition that they continue operating, yet you could be going back to that applicant under 1B and asking for all the tax credit back, when in fact that is not what was intended by this. We would propose that you add on line 27, sub 3, add back that pursuant to section 1A of this section, and then add to that, or for a renewable energy manufacturing facility, so that you would capture what they intended to do there, which was to capture both, under both scenarios, 1A and B above, and line 21 and 22, you'd capture it from the manufacturing facility, but you would not affect other facilities that are getting this. It's very complicated. I'm trying to make it simple, and I think it's very hard to do. I've had to read it several times. But that is, I think, an unintended consequence of removing that piece. The second piece I'd like to mention is in line 40 of the bill under subsection 4, they use the phrase any successor in interest. And our concern there is that, again, the the entity you want to capture in successor in interest is someone that buys the applicant, merges with the applicant, or somehow becomes involved and is the owner of the project. In fact, that term successor in interest could mean a creditor that forecloses. It could mean a bankruptcy trustee in bankruptcy, other types of successors in interest. In fact, a transferee of a tax credit could theoretically be a successor in interest. Again, something that we don't believe is intended in this situation. We'd like an opportunity to talk with Legislative Council and Legislative Revenue Office and see if we can't make an amendment that might solve those two particular problems. And with that, I'll open it to questions.
Thank you. Under the successor language that you just brought up, would a PPA provider with a 20 or 25-year term, would that qualify as a successor under your concern?
A PPA provider, you mean a power purchaser?
Power purchase provider, the people who provided the finance for it.
If they are a creditor and they foreclosed on their interest, they could be the successor in interest. And a creditor alone would not be a successor in interest.
But a PPA provider would be, who's got a note on a project for 20 or 25 years.
Well, it could be like a lender or anybody else. If they have not foreclosed and stepped into the shoes of the applicant, they aren't a successor in interest yet. They'd be a lender or they would be a PPA provider or someone that has a note.
Follow-up question. The client that you represent would probably be trying to do mezzanine round of financing for these kinds of projects, correct?
Yes, they would be bringing multiple transferees into the process to obtain the tax credit only. They would not be operating in the
You don't want the Department of Energy to hear you say for that only because they don't like the Betsy to be monetized. I'm winking. But after that project is financed, it is usually sold off to the paper on that is going to be sold into a mutual fund or an institutional investor who's going to hold that note.
Are you talking about the project or the tax credit?
Either or. Probably the project, not the tax credit.
And
the project's sold, and so that's why the successor language scares me a little bit. You just brought that up.
I believe, Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, that the person such as a sale of this project to some other entity, that is the successor in interest that they wish to capture, is someone that has acquired the facility.
Right.
But what we're trying not to have it mean is other types of successor in interest. That's a very broad term. And what we're trying to say is that you don't want the transferee of the tax credit to be captured by this, and you don't want, I don't believe, a bankruptcy trustee or other successors. But you would want someone that has purchased in some fashion or merged or purchased the facility itself. They are in the line. They should be in the line with the applicant. These other entities are successors in interest if they come up, but would not be. I don't
think successor. You're just to be simple, because I'm just a simple country boy from Southern Oregon, first time ever the big city. Your only concern then has to do with the transferability of the credit.
Yes, our primary interest is the absolute sanctity of the transfer of the tax credit to a transferee that's paid fair market value for it, that they cannot be brought back.
Thank you.
But doesn't the Dash 17 really deal with that?
It does for a transferee under subsection 6. What we brought up in this situation under successor in interest is other types of successors in interest that could be captured in this. And what we're concerned about is, again, that there is there's a lot of clarity in that line 40 as to who a successor in interest is. Subsection 6 basically says notwithstanding 1 through 5, a transferee can go there. So I'm not saying the successor in interest, and I may be correcting what I said to Senator Atkinson, is necessarily a concern to the transferee, but could be for other types of successor in interest that would be different than someone that has acquired the interest of the applicant.
So how would that affect the holder of the credit then?
I don't think about, this is something I was offering that we saw in this language that we're trying to make the entire system of working. We don't have enough definitions of what is a certificate, what is a transferee, what is a successor in interest. We think you're using a term of art in there that is probably describing too many people, too many persons in there, and there's a better way to do it, we believe. If you choose not to, you may choose not to. I think subsection 6 does adequately address the issue of the transferee. We would prefer the add section 4 next to section 3 on line 16 of the dash A17s because we think they should be exempt from both 4 and 3 in terms of liability. And that was the only other correction to dash A17 that we were thinking we should add, is that the transferee should be exempt from both subsection 4 and subsection 3.
Waiting for it to see if I can find Kate Toswell from Legislative Council. She was in here earlier. This is really a question for her. Although, Mike, did you have anything you wanted to?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, Mike Rainey from Department of Energy. I think the intent, I think everybody's in agreement on, is the question of whether the language does it. The pass-through is very important because that allows a lot of projects that the small businesses and public sector to take advantage of that wouldn't otherwise be able to use the credit. So we definitely want to make sure that the pass-through purchasers are protected, and I think Section 17 does that. The only time that we would impose any conditions, again, goes back to those economic parameters for manufacturing facilities. We don't, when somebody gets a tax credit for an energy efficiency project or a renewable energy project, we don't require it to operate for X years or anything like that. This is unique to these manufacturing facilities. So I think the language addresses these problems, and what I discussed with Mr. Doherty, because of the time in the session is late, if there's not the ability to clarify this further, and you're really getting beyond my knowledge of tax law, that we could work on this in the interim and come back in 09, because I don't anticipate that we would be in a situation where we would actually have to go back and ask for a revocation in that time frame. We have a couple of applications pending from large manufacturing facilities that we'll be reviewing. We have some that we're negotiating with, potentially of other companies. But that time will take time to do over the, I think, the coming months into the next year. And any failure to meet those conditions would be, I think, a year or more down the road if that unfortunate situation were to happen. So I don't think that anyone would be adversely affected by that provision if you adopt section the 17-17 amendments also, which we also support.
Madam Chair, could I try one time to clarify a little bit my point?
Yeah, and I'd also like your comments on if we hold this another day, since it has to have concurrence over in the House, the more this gets delayed, the more at risk the whole bill is.
I appreciate it, Madam Chair. I do not want to delay this bill. I think it is a good bill, and we are here supporting it. I have the example I'm using on successor in interest would be a lender that looks at the lender's liability if this project failed, and if the lender was then determined to be a successor in interest, the lender not only would lose its money, but would be liable to pay the tax credit money that went out to this. That's the concern, and it might chill lending in this area if they could possibly be considered a successor in interest.
Okay, I see. You've called Deborah Buchanan. Right. So
I think this is
that looks like a good
a tax law issue than an energy law issue, I'm sure.
I might add that I've exhausted my tax expertise.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. Let me state up front, Madam Chair, I'm not an attorney, but if it's clear that the intent of the committee, of the legislature, is in using the phrase successor in interest to only include those that purchase a project for fair value, then that's how we would interpret those terms. I think Director Graney makes a very good point that as I read this, it applies for certification starting in 2008. The credit could not possibly be claimed
until tax year 2008 returns are filed. The earliest those would be coming in to us is April of 2009. If the 2009 session tried to clarify this language, then that would be helpful too. But again, it does seem that there would be a small risk in going ahead with the language as it is. Presumably there would not be revocations before you meet again in 2009.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Are there other questions from the committee?
Thank you.
Thank you all. I want to, before we close today, and I'm leaning toward using our meeting tomorrow just to, so I can get a comfort level with legislative council, and maybe others on the committee can get a comfort level. But I wanted to let the housing people have a chance to talk about their part of this bill. If they came all this way, appreciate it. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Rick Craker. I'm the Deputy Director for Oregon Housing Community Services, and with me is John Fletcher. He's our Senior Policy Advisor for the Department. First of all, I want to thank the Senate Revenue Committee and your willingness to listen to us in relation to the issue of affordable housing. We took the time in the fall to have a special session to really listen to some of the issues that we're dealing with as it relates to preservation, manufactured dwelling parks, workforce housing, et cetera. So really appreciate the time that you've taken. In addition, I want to thank the Revenue Committee last session, and where this leads into House Bill 3619 is you did increase the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit last session from $11 million to $13 million. But more importantly, you made a real critical change to the law that would allow us to use the Affordable Housing Tax Credit in our effort to preserve federally subsidized housing projects. There are many of these projects around the state that are going to begin expiring between now and 2013 in the neighborhood of 7,000 units. And these are projects that are providing homes for the very lowest income Oregonians, typically those that are 30% area median income and below. So we were very grateful for the increase last session. What we did is there was a request last session to go from $11 million to $15 million. The Revenue Committee increased it from $11 to $13 and told us, you know, go to work and come back and see us if there is a need for more down the road. So during this last, or beginning July 1st, 2007, the Department was able to utilize this tool, and we were able to preserve more than 1,600 units of federally subsidized housing around the state, which accounted for almost $260 million of federal subsidies that will now stay in this state for the next 20 years. So very pleased with that effort. The problem is, that is facing us at this point, though, is there's still more units out there, and we've run to the point of maximizing our $13 million cap. We no longer can provide any more affordable housing tax credits for any of these preservation projects. What we're looking at in 2008 is approximately 1,800 units that will begin expiring. This is, I guess I would say, the first of the next 6 years, a wave of projects that will be expiring around the state. And I guess I do want to emphasize these are projects that are throughout the state. This is not an urban, rural type setting. This is all across the state. And in fact, for the 1,800 projects that we're looking at expiring here in 2008, they stretch across 40 different cities. So we're very concerned about this issue because, again, at this point, we do not have any tax credits to allocate. What I would also add to this is that, you know, there are a variety of concerns I know that the legislature has in terms of revenue impacts with very little revenue to allocate. This particular bill, this modification to increase the tax credit from $13 million to $17 million, will be a revenue impact that will not occur until after January 1st of 2009. It will not have an 07-09 fiscal impact. Typically, when we do these tax credits, we're looking anywhere between 18 and 24 months to do the rehabilitation and everything that's necessary to get the project up and running. So it will not have an impact into the 07-09 binding. It will not take effect until 9-11. I would like to just mention one more thing before I turn this over to John, and he's going to provide you with a little bit more information on the handouts that came around in terms of the specific outcomes we anticipate. As you may or may not know, there are two proposals that are out there now. This is a $4 million tax credit increase that is supported by the State Housing Council. There is also a request that is before the Ways and Means Committee for a $2 million general fund appropriation. I do want to say for the record that the Oregon Housing Community Service is supportive of both of these proposals. What they do is they work together. The $2 million general fund request that's being made currently through the Bumpkinson Bill 1073 provides financing that would create a short-term pool to preserve many of these projects that we're talking about. Again, I have 1,800 units that are coming due here in the next year, and my department staff, they work pretty quickly, but to do long-term affordable housing, it takes a while to put this together. So you're going to see from John's information here that, you know, we believe that we can respond with this tax rate increase for a number of those, but for us to be fully effective, it's going to require an approach that would be a short-term as well as a long-term. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll turn that over to John, and he can quickly go through some of the outcomes that we're anticipating.
Welcome to the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm John Fletcher. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor for Oregon Housing Community Services. And I know the time is late, and you've had a long day. As a department, we know that when we come to the Revenue Committee, you're always interested in accountability. If you're going to talk about revenue and tax credits, you want to know what you're getting. And in anticipation of that, we've prepared this one summary sheet that will talk about some of the outcomes we would expect if you were to approve the bill before you today, House Bill 3619, with the $4 million tax credit increase. First of all, if you look at the top row on the sheet, we're talking about the units at risk in 2008 only. There are units that are going to be at risk in future years. We're just trying to get through the biennium, through 2008, and we have 1,848 units that our current resources will not allow us to address, so those units are at risk. With the $4 million tax credit increase and assuming the passage of the $2 million general fund appropriation that's in Ways and Means under Senate Bill 1073, we project a target preservation percentage of 85% of those 1,800 units. Or, in other words, we can preserve 1,500 roughly of the 1,800 units. If we were not to get the general fund and we were to get the tax credits, which is your second column, that 85% target preservation percentage drops to roughly 40%, and that's because we're not able to move quickly. And I'm not going to cover everything on this handout, but what I will say is that there are revenue impacts that are in the positive economic stimulus if you look at the short term. There are social costs that are avoided. There are a lot of good things about preserving these units, especially millions of dollars of federal subsidy. So unless there are questions, I'll just refer the summary sheet to you. You can kind of look at the impacts and see the difference in the different scenarios and the importance of the bill before you today. And that concludes my testimony.
Thank you very much. Senator Monroe.
Yeah, do you have any assurance from the Ways and Means co-chairs that they're going to come up with the $2 million?
Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, we have no assurances at this point. We know that this is a bill that they're very interested in. Obviously, everybody was discouraged by the revenue forecast that we saw here a few weeks ago, but certainly there is a continued commitment on the part of the co-chairs to see if there are ways that can be funded. In addition, I would say, you know, again, this is a priority for not only the legislature but also for the department, so certainly we're going to provide, you know, whatever assistance we can as well.
I'm on Four Ways and Means, and we just passed out several bills today, all of which they took the dollars out of and left the good words but no money. So you might anticipate that might possibly occur to you as well.
Right. Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, we understand the situation that you're in currently, and certainly we just want to make sure that you understand, at least from an outcome standpoint, we believe we can do a lot of good work with the tax credits. We believe we've done a lot of good work with the tax credits. A great tool. It continue to be a great tool. You know, we can be even more productive, though, with the short-term piece. So,
They fit together.
They work together.
Okay, thank you. Well, you've got a lot of rooters on both of these things, so thank you for your good work. Any other questions?
Senator Atkinson, do you have any questions?
No, of you, Madam Chair. Are we going to move this evening?
No, we are not.
Okay, just a couple comments. The Department of Housing has been absolutely fabulous to work with on trying to resolve an issue in Southern Oregon. I have a policy issue that is dealing with low-income housing, in which I have a municipality that's about to, by passing this bill, get 200 units that are now going to qualify, and I can't seem to get satisfaction for one land property owner as hard as I've been trying, as many different ways as I've been trying. And so I'm very happy that this will not move today. And I also need to say this is a matter of being new to the Revenue Committee. When we do ultimately vote on this bill, I'll be declaring a conflict of interest. I run a company that works in renewable energy, and we work directly with clients and projects dealing with the Betsy. But what I don't understand is why these two things are bundled together. I mean, we have housing should be a standalone issue, and renewable energy Betsy should be a standalone issue. I just think this is I don't understand that, Madam Chair.
It has a lot to do with the shortness of time and the expansiveness of the relating clause.
which is why, Madam Chair, I'm paying particular interest to it.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I might just add for the record and to Senator Atkinson, I want him to know, and I've spoke to him, that we are going to continue to work with him and do whatever we can to help out in terms of his issue in Medford. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate that. Any other questions? Thank you. We have Jody Weiser as our last witness. And thank you for coming up. I'm sorry we made you wait so long.
Just glad to hear. Jane, LC's here.
I know. We're not gonna do it. I can't abuse my committee more than just a certain amount. Welcome.
Thank you. Jody Weiser for the record. I think both parts of this bill are wonderful. I think that it's really important that we do what we need to do for housing. And I think it makes no sense that we left out manufacturing last time around. It just kind of shows how we did the bill too fast. It makes way more sense that we do manufacturing than we do the wind that's in the old bill. And I'm glad to see that we're starting to do some standards. It concerns me a bit that the standards are really unclear. Like, is it like just how many jobs, or is there something about quality of jobs? And I'm not sure that the Department of Energy, rather than the legislature, should be deciding what we want our standards to be for that kind of issue. But given the time we have available, I think this is the way we're going to fly, and we'll hope it doesn't change. It's scary that this is another tax credit bill that we did not put a sunset on, and so we can't really go back and consider if we've made a mistake.
So this has a sunset.
The whole energy part does?
Yeah.
Yes,
so what's the sunset? I didn't
2012 find. Or 2013?
I think January and 2014.
So the newspaper, I'm sorry that I didn't realize that. The newspaper has said so far that we've given $44 million to wind, and that's just in two projects. And the newspapers also said, and I don't know if this particular project owned by the same PPG, I think it's called, international company, obviously going out there to buy many, many, many megawatts of power, would come here anyway because we have wind and because we have renewable standards that require that they buy wind. So we're giving them a pile of money. And one of the facilities is selling all of its power to California, which means that this will for sure be a $10 corporation in our state. And wind provides about 5 operation and maintenance jobs per 50 megawatts. I believe I've I have to find those statistics here. Because five operation and maintenance jobs for about 25 towers. So we're really creating very few jobs. And we're, in some cases, going to export all of the products, so we're not going to have any income taxes. So all we have is some increase in property taxes to those counties. Now, wind farms are going into some very poor counties, so it's important that they get whatever revenue they can get. But I wonder if there's any necessity at all for the fact that we're giving tax credits to those projects. And I'd hate to think we have to wait until the sunset to reconsider that, because we might have used up all of the landscape we have available for wind before they get to that end point. We spoke with Dr. Ryan Weiser, who works at Lawrence Berkeley Labs and is a leading authority in the world on wind power, and he says that it makes no sense for Oregon or other states to provide economic incentives to get wind built in their states. The tax credits are creating inequities in a place where market forces and public utility regulation should be at work. We have wind. We have standards. They will come. That's basically what he says. So I know that we're not going to consider that piece of this legislation this time, but I think we should talk about it in 2009.
Thank you. You know, if you can prove that they'll come anyway, the dash A... What is it? 13 Amendment is aimed at that. It is aimed at companies that would come here otherwise.
I noticed that, and I wondered how you would figure the standard out, and I hope that it could be applied perhaps in this way. When I read those amendments, I thought, well, that might work, but it could also lead to litigation, because how do you figure that out? I mean, Solar World already has their acres. They already have a bunch of buildings. Are they going to not build the next arm of their facility?
Well, it's a start.
It's a start. I'm glad to see it. Yeah. Thank you.
Questions? Okay. Committee, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3619, and we will meet tomorrow to try to get this bill out. I just wanted to have some of the issues that... Paul? At 1 o'clock, yes. Mm-hmm. 1 o'clock, our regular meeting time, so you won't have to scurry back and forth from ways and means this time.
And I will be testifying on another bill at 1 o'clock, though, but it shouldn't take too long.
Well, we'll accommodate you, Senator Monroe. So thank you, committee, for meeting at this irregular time and for sticking through it, and we are adjourned.